Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum, and welcome Representative Hortman. Representative Hortman, you have House File 2543, and I'll move that House File 2543 be re-referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration. If you would, you have an amendment. Would you like me to proceed with the amendment?
That would be great, Madam Chair.
All right. The author's amendment, members, is A6, and I'll move the A6 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment is adopted. So, with that, Representative Portman, would you like to describe your bill and as amended?
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm really impressed that you got a quorum so fast after your convening time. This bill, House File 2543, is a PCA policy bill this year. It's about streamlining and regulating efficiency. Folks might recall in 2009, okay, that's too much. In 2009 and 10, the Small Business Caucus started working on the issues of regulating efficiency and moving things a little quicker where they can be, but still be protective of the environment. And that process moved forward through from 2009 to 2011. Now, this is an agency-driven initiative to make things more efficient. And, Madam Chair, just a quick explanation of why we're here past the deadlines. Our understanding was that you needed to land in the Finance Committee by last Friday, not that you needed to be heard in the Finance Committee by last Friday. So that's why we're going to rules next. And, Madam Chair, I have Kirk Kadelka from the Pollution Control Agency to explain the bill.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I don't know what would be preferred. I could go through it as the order appears on the fact sheet or the bill, depending on which is better for the chair.
I think we should go through it. It's up to you. It doesn't matter.
Okay. We can go through the order of the bill, and I can refer back to the fact sheet as needed. The first section of the bill really deals with MPCA's effort to build a new electronic information management system. We have a number of old data databases that we are in the process of evolving and also making more of our services available through electronic means. And one of the things that we're looking to do is having the ability for regulated parties or individuals to work on reports or applications, save them, come back to them later, work on them again, save them, and then when they find it's deemed time to send it over to the agency, they can do so. We compare this to TurboTax. Just like at home, you can work on your tax documents, save it, and keep working on it, and at a certain point when you want to, you then send it to the Department of Revenue, and then your data becomes part of the government realm. We would do the same here so that electronic documents are handled the same way if someone was doing a paper document. It's not until they actually take that act of sending it to the agency does it become public information. Section 2 of the bill deals with DNR and permitting tiers of 150 days and 90 days and consolidates a twice a year permitting efficiency report to an annual report, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later when we get to it in the PCA provisions. Same with Section 3, it's a DNR's expedited permitting process, which MPCA has and expands in this bill, and I'll talk about it a little bit more in that area. Section 4 and 13 of the bill deal with non-federal water and solid waste permits. Currently, most of our permits are 5 years, except for state feedlot and state solid waste permits. We would like to make the rest of our water, non-federal water, and solid waste permits the same. So these are transfer stations, compost facilities, large cluster septic systems that would be 10 years. The advantage to the permittee is they wouldn't have to spend the time or hire a contractor to work on the application and after 5 years and save that application fee. We can only do these with state permits, not federal permits, because under federal law, the Clean Air and Clean Water Act, they're required to be 5 years. Section 5 expands our current authority for water quality trading. As time has evolved and we have different types of water standards that in some cases become more stringent and more difficult for folks to meet, there are different sources of the same pollution that can cost different amounts to correct. And so what we'd like to do is open it up so we can do trading more often. One current way that we've used trading right now is in the Minnesota River Basin. And an example of this is the community of Sacred Heart. They pay $400 a year to meet their phosphorus reductions by trading with the city of Mankato. Without trading, they would be looking at a multi-million dollar investment in their wastewater infrastructure. What we'd like to do is open this up for other pollutants beyond nutrients, which is allowed under the current law, and also expanded for, currently it's only allowed for newer expanding discharge or those in impaired waters. We'd like to open that up. This would help drive a market system that would allow for the same or better reductions in pollutants and have it at a lower cost for the permittee. And we think this additional flexibility could come in handy in a number of different areas. We've added language through the process, responding to requests from the Minnesota Center of Environmental Advocacy to make sure that there are protections and sideboards in place, and also talking to the chamber, we clarified to make sure this is a voluntary process. The two parties have to come to agreement on this. It's not the agency forcing two parties into a trade, but once the agreement is made, they are documented in permits, which is a public process, and once you're locked in, you do have to meet those requirements. Section 6 of the bill deals with septic tank payment system improvements. Currently, we have a complex system that involves counties, the agency, and septic system installers, and there is a tank fee system that's paid back. What we'd like to do is streamline this process and make it less confusing, take out some of the steps. The fee stays the same. However, this would make it much easier, especially on the installers, to move forward on this process. Section 7, we come back to the permitting tiers and report consolidation. We would create two goals. As mentioned earlier, we've been working for a while on permit efficiency, and for construction permits, those new permits or those for expansions, we're hitting 97% of those priority permits in 150 days. What we'd like to do is create a two-tiered system for goals, one being 90 days and one being 150 days. Those that would fall under the 150 days would have public comment periods or require individual actions. An example of that would be a municipal stormwater permit. They have an individual plan that needs to be turned into the agency and reviewed that's above and beyond what's allowed in the general permit. This would be a way for us to measure our progress on those smaller permits that take time but don't need the full 150 days. Section 8 of the bill deals with the expedited permitting process. This is a voluntary program, and currently it works in two ways. If someone's in a waiting queue for a permit writer to be assigned to them, or they are already have a permit writer assigned to them and they would like additional hours, whether it's overtime or the like, to be used to help move their permit through the system faster. What we're doing here is expanding this and would allow for other opportunities for regular time work to be used in cases or bring on additional staff. An example is when the ethanol industry came about, they really were moving at quite a pace. They wanted to strike while the iron's hot, and the agency didn't quite have the resources to help move through that chunk of facilities through and spend the proper amount of time on it. So what it ended up is, to ensure environmental protection and the proper amount of time was spent, is that it took longer than what was probably liked by the permit facilities. This would allow for them, if they would like at that point, to pay for additional charges. When a big group comes through, the agency could staff up. When that goes away, we could staff back down. Instead of requiring higher fees for everyone on permits to have additional staff for when it possibly could be needed, this would be for us to react when called upon. Section 9 of the bill deals with our administrative penalty order and creating a more efficient and simpler process. There are a number of compliance and enforcement changes in the bill for timeliness. We have worked very hard on permit timeliness, but we also believe to meet our goal of protecting and improving the environment and enhancing public health, we also need to make sure compliance and enforcement cases are handled in an efficient manner. This also has a direct impact on permitting efficiency. Sometimes one of the reasons for a delay or permit taking longer is because there's a non-compliance issue. Before the agency can issue a new permit for a new facility or an expansion, we need to make sure the compliance issues are cleared up and have that taken care of. So a quicker way for folks to come through the compliance system would also help in that case their permitting. What this is not is a change in the maximum amount that MPCA can assess in penalties. That is an entirely different chapter. That's chapter 115, and that has statutory maximum limits of $10,000 per day per violation and $25,000 per day per violation for hazardous waste. I have a copy of that statute if folks would like to compare that to the bill, but it is an entirely different section of statute. What some have compared this to is conciliation court. A number of years ago, they increased the amount of claim that could go into this process and open up access to a simpler process for individuals. And in this case, the benefit to regulated parties include less time-consuming process that takes them away from their business and their higher priorities. APOs, or administrative penalty orders, on average take 256 days versus the other tool we use, if it's over 10,000, a stipulation agreement, which takes 865 days from discovery to closure. There's less need for attorneys and higher attorney fees that come along with them if going through the administrative penalty order. It also brings closure to an issue quicker, which has environmental benefits, but also many regulated parties want to clear their record faster. They want to be in compliance, and they would like not to have it drag out. And I again mentioned permit timeliness. If there's an open enforcement action, it also helps us to close those so that an expansion permit or others could be taken care of. This section makes two other small changes. One is it corrects a misinterpretation, we believe, of the statute, which if there is a case such as a significant asbestos removal violation where it includes multiple parties, a removal contractor, a demo contractor, and a project manager, they could all be, what we typically do is we look at the violation, see what the potential harm was to the environment, see if it was something that's a pattern, is there a history of this, if it was willful, that they did it on purpose versus something they may have oversight. There's a number of factors that go in, and we set and figure out what is the remedy to bring them back in the compliance, whether it's a cleanup or changes in their practice, but also if a penalty is warranted. That's when we set what the penalty amount could be by looking at other similar cases. It's once that amount's set, we then look to see what tool we use. And in this case, if it's under $10,000, we currently can use an APO. In that case where there were three parties involved, the way that this has been interpreted by the courts is that we can only use an APO if all of their penalties were under $10,000. What it does, it creates a fleet rate for violations and puts them into a much more complex system. We'd like to clarify that and put it on the same terms as other agencies. Finally, this also changes the $20,000 limit on when we can use an APO and allows for it to be corrected by inflation. So as we continue to move on, the access to that quicker, simpler process isn't shrunk and reduced by inflation eating away at it. Sections 10 and 11 allow for field citations for septic violations, SSTS violations. What we did is we looked at the common violations for septic professionals and businesses, and they all tend to seem to fall in these same buckets, not only in the category of violation, but also in the penalty amounts. As a result, we thought it would be much quicker for all parties involved if we'd move to a schedule of penalties, which you'll see in Section 11 of the bill, which dictates how much that is, including maximums, so that there is a higher level that this can only be used at, which is $2,000. And we've split the violations in two different groups, one of environmental, human health, and consumer protection violations versus the more typical paperwork violations. This still allows an appeals process that includes an administrative law judge reviewing it, just like an administrative penalty order. And we've worked with the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association on this, and they are neutral on the change. The last provision is Section 12. It's dealing with Minnesota Business First Stop. It's a fee-for-service expansion. When businesses come in through Minnesota Business First Stop or sometimes straight to the agency, they don't even have an application in mind. They don't even have the fine-tuned project. ready to hand to the agency, they're asking us, is this even feasible? This really happens on large, complex projects or new technologies. They want to spend that time to see if it's even worth doing it, or how do they tailor their project into a way that can be permittable. We provide this service now when we can. Our priority does go to those applications already in-house. But again, we'd like to offer this availability if an industry was coming in and they want to strike while the iron's hot and the timing's right, and what they would need above and beyond what we can provide at the time. To date, no one's been charged for the service through Minnesota Business First Stop by MPCA, but it offers that ability if we were to get a large bulk amount coming through at the same time. Madam Chair and committee members, that's the bill. I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, in Section 4, lines 6.35, you talk about the SDS permit. And my question would be, does that also include livestock? I guess I didn't catch that. Are we going to extend that to 10 years as well, the livestock permits?
Madam Chair and committee members, feedlots are a little bit more detailed. There is the federal feedlot permit, which has to stay at 5 years. In previous years, the legislature has already changed feedlot state permits to 10 years. So they're already at that level. We're bringing everyone else up to that same level. So there's no changes for feedlots in this bill.
Thank you.
Representative Torkel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kudelka, first I'd like to take a look at Section 5 of the bill, the pollutant loading offset, the trading section. From your notes, it seems to indicate that we can do this now post-TMDL. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm just looking at this. The current language on the amendment, the A6 amendment, that first sentence there talks about the prior to the completion of a TMDL for an impaired water. And so that's one of the things that we're moving out. And then also on lines 1.6 of the amendment, the language, we're striking the new discharge or expanded discharges. So there are some times where this is limited. Well, we'd like to be able to use it in a protection area. So if an impaired water isn't already deemed that, we would like to allow for facilities within that same watershed to be able to trade in efforts to protect the water. That's what one of the advances on this. After the TMDL, according to law, we couldn't do any type of trading.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So it's still, if a TMDL is in place, you will not be able to do trading. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and committee members, with the amendment, we will be able to do trading.
You will be able to do trading.
Correct.
Once, even though a TMDL is in place.
Correct.
Thank you. I just want to make that clear. Then, Madam Chair, thank you. Moving on to Section 9 of the bill, where we have the change in the structure and amount of penalties. Currently, when you apply administrative permitting order, it's applied in general. It's one penalty for the entire group of contractors involved. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and committee members, if we were to use an administrative penalty order, if there was the case where we couldn't use it, there were other tools we could use. For instance, let's use the case again of the asbestos violation, and each of them, after looking at the many factors involved, each of them looked that it should be $7,000 each. In aggregate, that's over the $10,000, so according to the current interpretation, we couldn't use an APO. What we would do is we'd use a stipulation agreement. And that's a much lengthier process, and our stats show that takes usually four times as long as what it would be for an administrative penalty order. So you're correct that the change would allow for us to be able to do it much quicker, take care of all of them in one action, get to resolution quicker versus the current process where we would have to use a longer and a different tool.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but it also allows you to fine each of these parties involved individually, and you can't do that today. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and committee members, using that tool. We can do it individually if we use a different tool. What we'd like to do is just be able to use a simpler tool for these types and treat them individually versus a group. We could still do a stipulation agreement with each of them individually if we wanted to under the current law, but it's a much more complex system and usually incurs more time for the permittee or the potential violator, and it also usually involves more attorney time and higher costs for them.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it just, you know, it seems to me there's a risk here that it's going to make it easier for you to find more people for more money and increase your revenues. We've seen some evidence of that in the past, and that's my concern here in this particular issue, that it's making it easier for the agency to take more money out of more people more quickly.
Perhaps you should explain a bit more about what's involved in a stipulation agreement. Mm-hmm. Could you do that, Mr. Kudelka?
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask for a colleague to help me with that on the details.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Katie Kelfkin. I'm the manager of land and air compliance at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Thank you. There's this question about using a more complex stipulation agreement, and I think it would be helpful if committee members understood what was involved in that more complex.
Yes, Madam Chair, committee members, a stipulation agreement is a negotiated agreement between the MPCA and a regulated party. A draft agreement will be sent out to the regulated party for review of the background of the case, the violations that are being alleged, and a potential penalty, as well as corrective actions. What then happens is the MPCA and the party will meet and discuss the terms of the agreement. An attorney is almost always present with the regulated party to help ensure that, you know, the party understands the stipulation agreement, because it is a very lengthy, full of legalese agreement. Oftentimes, there will be several meetings to negotiate this particular document before it is finally agreed upon by terms that the MPCA can accept as well as the regulated party. For an administrative penalty order, conversely, that is a document that is issued. The regulated party then has 30 days to appeal that APO to an administrative law judge or to district court.
I think that just to help make the distinction between the two. Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, and I'm not sure who wants to answer this, but will this change result in more revenue for the agency?
Madam Chair, committee members, it will not. We would simply just use a different tool. As Mr. Kudelka was explaining earlier, for example, if we had an asbestos case where there were two parties that we feel, according to our guidelines, should receive a $7,000 penalty each, we would not be able to issue two administrative penalty orders, because that would exceed what the courts have interpreted as a $10,000 aggregate cap over the inspection or that particular situation. Instead, we would have to do a stipulation agreement with each of those companies. So the amount of the penalties would remain the same. It would just have to use the lengthier tool because of that cap.
Chair, if I could contribute two things. One, there's a fiscal note on the bill that shows a savings, and I think if they were likely to generate more fines and revenue, then we would have a projected increase. And the second thing, the average length of an APO is 250-some days. The average length of a stipulation agreement is 865 days. So it's really, in terms of the cost to a party, a vast difference in terms of the transaction cost.
Representative Dill.
Thank you. Chair Wagini, I'm going back a little bit, Mr. Kudelka, what you said, I was talking about renewing permits, and there were violations in place. I think I heard you say that you couldn't issue a new permit without the violations or exceedances being remedied. I think you said that. I'm not sure.
Representative Dill, could you speak more into your mouth?
I thought that you could issue a new permit if you had a stipulation agreement on the violations, if you had a consent decree, or you incorporated the remediation in the permit. Is that Is that correct? Kind of put that back together for me, if you would.
Madam Chair and committee members, you're correct. It was expanding a little bit more. Part of our closure to a penalty could include a stipulation agreement or a schedule of compliance or consent order. Having that in place and having a route for them to do what they need to do over time, in a case where a feedlot, where maybe it's a manure storage system needs to take months to complete, or a mine where it may take years to put in a new system, you could come to a closure on the compliance issue with that schedule, and they have to meet it, and then we could at the same time be working on a permit or an expansion. So the compliance issue is deemed closed because they have a schedule moving forward to complete it.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Was there another question over here? Representative Torkelson?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up a little more, now that we've got the fiscal note, the savings apparently in the fiscal note are based on less litigation. Is that less expense for the agency to explain it to me. Explain the fiscal note to me, please.
Madam Chair and committee members, it's both. If you're looking on page 6 of the fiscal note, on section 9 there, that bullet, we show what the amount it takes for the agency internally for an APO versus a stipulation agreement. As was mentioned earlier, a lot of those times, those meetings are held simultaneously with the agency, with the regulated party. So that's their time invested in this also, because just like the agency, when we're working to prepare something, once they're handed something, they're using their additional time also to spend reviewing it. So there is may not be a one-for-one comparison on the amount of hours taken on behalf of the other party, but there is a considerable additional amount of time spent by the party during the process. The fiscal note doesn't quantify the savings for regulated parties, just the agency.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So these savings are staff time savings? Is that what it boils down to?
Madam Chair and committee members, correct, because the fiscal note only measures what's the agency's portion of it, but there are savings for the regulated parties also.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, you're saving some money. I don't see any change in revenues on your fiscal note, but yet there's some history with the PCA of taking in lots of money in some cases, and especially after we made a change to see that all your fines stayed within the agency. I feel there's some risk here that it may just be another effort to siphon some more money out of our businesses.
Representative Babian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I had some questions in line with what Representative Torkelson was asking, so I'll kind of pass on those. But I know Mr. Kadelka on Section 2, and throughout the bill you talk about increasing efficiencies and speeding things up and making it easier and so forth. But I noticed that on lines 1.20 and 1.21, the number of days to issue or deny a permit is not changing. And you talk about increasing efficiencies and so forth, but you don't seem to be holding yourself to a higher standard when it comes to speeding things up with regards to the number of days. Can you explain that, please?
Madam Chair and committee members, the bill does change. Everyone being under the 150-day cap to the 90-day goal. So there is specifically, Section 2 is the DNR, but later in the PCA section, we do specifically hold ourselves to a tighter standard. Where the goal language really hasn't helped the most is when we go through the measurement and the reporting, we identify kind of choke points or parts that really do create bottlenecks. And that's a good opportunity there for the agency to then take a finer look at that, whether it's through a continuous improvement project or working with the chamber. For instance, we have a quarterly meeting with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce along with a number of consulting firms on air permitting. We know modeling is one of those areas where when we start going through the process, it takes longer. And so we are continuing to work on ways to help with better communication, make sure we all have understandings of what is expected of each other, and also looking for where there could be additional efficiencies in that regard. So the goals serve a very important purpose in that regard, and we have seen benefits as a result of it. The goal is also what we drive towards. We have a strong history within the agency for over 10 years of continuous improvement efforts in various forms, and a number of our projects that we worked on this year that we presented to our board at our annual symposium on continuous improvement are specifically tied to permitting efficiency. That includes our IT transformation that we're currently undertaking right now, which will help making a lot more of this through electronic system, less re-entering of data work, also allowing for applicants to put in information in another format. This is all going to help us continue to move faster on permitting.
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, the Section 2 is actually language that you and I both carried. I carried it in 2010,
yeah.
And I think we got it adopted as to the Department of Ag, and I think you carried the same language in 2011 and got it applied to DNR and PCA. And prior to our legislation, there was no goal in statute. We put the 150-day goal in statute, and they're bumping it up to 90 days
right.
for certain projects. So they're seeing our 150 and raising us to 90.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was speaking specifically about the Tier 2 permits. I mean, the Tier 1 permits, quite frankly, Mr. Kadelka, give us some data on the average length that it takes to issue a permit in that Tier 1 category.
Madam Chair and committee members, for our Tier 1 permits, we have a gamut of them. We have some that can be done in 2 to 7 days, which are our construction stormwater. We have general permits or registration permits, which do take up to that 90 days. When we get a permit, and those that are in the Tier 1, and just to give you a kind of a understanding of the universe we're talking about, the agency has about 15,000 permits. We anticipate with this change, 75% or so would fall under Tier 1 or 90-day goal. So that's a large majority of the permits that we work on. Those also tend to be the ones that aren't involving consultants. So it's someone who is the first time working into the regulatory system, a small business owner, or someone else. And so there is the opportunity there. We need the give and take to go back and forth. That application, when we do the completeness on the first blush, really is to see if there are some egregious things not there. But there's continuing conversations back and forth with the regulated party and the agency, one, to make sure we get the information to put in the correct permit, and then two, it's important for us to give the permit back to the applicant so they have time to review it, so they understand what is being expected of them, and so that they feel that they're comfortable with it, or if they would like to do some changes. That takes time, and that is what does fall under 90 days. Under the 150 days, those are ones that require public comments. A public comment period alone adds close to 60 days to this process. You have the at least 30-day public comment period. You have a week or more on the front end to put it out for notice so folks understand it's coming out. And on the back end, you have a couple weeks of responding to the comments that we get in, addressing any changes that need to be done in the permit because of new information from the applicant or the public and their public comments or other local units of government. That takes time and needs to be done to make sure that we have a permit that not only meets the needs of the regulated party, but also fits within the regulatory system of the state. Those 25% and that 150-day goal, if we just moved it down to 90, we would be creating a false assumption amongst everyone to say that, you know, you're going to make it 90. When we know the first 60 days there alone is just the public comment period. That's no time to work on a permit. We don't want to create false assumptions in people's heads and have them start planning on it and then find out their whole system's backed up.
Representative, did you have a last question?
I have another question, please. Yes. Try to find that. In Section 8 of the bill, you talked about the ethanol industry a few years ago, that this might be something that may have been helpful to them to be able to expedite things. And and you also talked about staffing up and staffing down. Explain to me how you staff up and staff down with an MPCA with regards to the permitting process.
Madam Chair and committee members, if we were to get a large amount of similar permits coming through, we could bring on additional staff to handle those. And then through the natural churn, permit writers within the agency are ones that turn over quite frequently. They find more lucrative jobs in the consulting industry or the like, so they could come in and just fill in the backfill. Or we could bring them on knowing that it would be a temporary basis. On the ethanol comparison, a number of years ago, there were a number of them that came through at the same time, and they were experiencing difficulties getting it in a timely fashion. The legislature ended up putting a large appropriation to help the agency to deal with those type of permits. In that case, all permittees ended up paying because it became the entire permit fee structure that's paying for it paid for the service and not that one individual sector that was seeing that faster turnaround. And so that's what we're trying to move at. We could just staff up even more permit riders and have them available if something were to come on, but there are times they would be idle, and we would rather see how this goes, see what the demand is, and then staff up and down appropriately instead of just asking for a number of additional staff at this time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, in the staffing up and the staffing down, do you contract with private engineering firms or anything like that to help you with the process?
Madam Chair and committee members, we do have that option. It is not our first choice. Our first choice is for staff to see if they can do overtime because they're the same ones working on these projects day in and day out. Having a consultant do it sometimes means bringing them up to speed to the issue to make sure it's done in the way that is similar to other permits. It also means another level of oversight. In the end, it actually is more work and more expense for the agency for a consultant in some cases than if we could have staff that can spend overtime or have been trained in the area already.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one more question with regards to Section 8. Through this process, I want to make sure that if somebody decides to pay the fees so that they can have more work done more efficiently, whatever the terms were that you used, that somehow within the agency that doesn't push other permit applicants to the bottom of the pile, that they are still going to be assured that that their permits are going to be handled in a timely manner and there's not going to be any delays because somebody else is using this section in the bill. Is that your intention?
Madam Chair and committee members, that is our intention. We tend to use overtime as our first line of adding hours because it doesn't impact everyone else. It's the time above and beyond what's already allocated by staff, and that's specifically because we do want them to be handled in such a way. This also does keep the power with the agency. The agency is the one that gets to decide finally if an expedited process works. If for some reason we look at the project and see that, you know, we're going to maybe shave off a little bit of time, but it's going to put much more strain on the system, we can deny it under those grounds because we don't want to put those others at risk. There's a basic level of service that permittees that are in-house already are expect and are entitled to, and we want to keep those at that same level.
Last question, Madam Chair, and this may be for DNR, I'm not sure. In Section 10 of the bill, and this isn't new language, but I do want some clarification. It says on lines 13.19 and 13.2 that PCA staff designated by commissioner and the Department of Natural Resources conservation officers may issue citations. I'm curious to know what is the specific training that DNR conservation officers go through with regards to SSTS inspections.
We can have that question. This is not a change in the bill. So I want to make sure all the questions for changes get done. But if DNR would want to say something quick about this.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Bob Murray, Department of Natural Resources. I need to check the specific training of SSTS applications. Most of the time I would assume our officers are taking the lead of the PCA agency and we're just the issuing agent, so to speak, the citation. as we have that enforcement authority, just like we have the enforcement authority for a Wetland Conservation Act under Bowser, we do have, actually, in that case, wetland enforcement officers. But we're working very closely with the other agencies and taking their professional expertise and just applying it to our enforcement capabilities.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Anderson is next.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions. Mr. Kadalka, again going back to Section 9 and the inflation factor on penalties, when you assess a penalty or a fine, is there actually some basis for the number? I think back to an ethanol plant in my area a while back that was assessed a huge fine for burning one treated piece of lumber, and far above the damages it caused. So when you talk about inflation being added to a penalty, what basis is there, or what inflation is there in terms of a penalty?
Madam Chair and committee members, the limits on what a penalty can be assessed are in a different section of statute, that's Chapter 115. That does not have the inflation piece connected to it at all. So the maximum amount of penalty that can be charged for a violation will not change with inflation. What is changing with inflation is when we can use the APO as a tool, the administrative penalty order, so that 20 years from now, $20,000 will be less, and that will be, mean less folks can have access to that capabilities. So it's not changing the case of what the penalty amount is for the individual. We do that before we get to the tool. The inflation more is just to determine what path they might be able to travel through.
But what is that $20,000 based on?
Madam Chair, committee members, the MPCA has a penalty policy, as does the Environmental Protection Agency that we also follow. According to statute, we must consider the potential for harm from the violations, how far the company was out of compliance. We must recover any economic benefit that was gained, any other factors that are necessary if the conduct appears to be willful. So we have a specified procedure we go through following a process and documentation to ensure that we are being consistent in following our own internal and EPA policy and making sure that we're following precedents we have set in the past to make sure they're consistent. Also keeping in mind that, again, administrative penalty orders can be appealed to an administrative law judge and district court, so we must ensure that we have the facts and the penalty that is reasonable and appropriate for each case.
One more question, Madam Chair. On Section 10, the language at the bottom of page 13, the new language about penalties for SSTS systems, how will that be enforced in terms of, this would have to be an on-site type of inspection. Who will have the authority to come on somebody's property to inspect this, and is there any change here from current procedure?
Madam Chair, committee members, MPCA inspectors do have statutory authority to conduct inspections to carry out the environmental laws of the state. Using citation authority will not be that much different than doing, you know, an administrative penalty order. A staff member will go on site, conduct the inspection, gather information, oftentimes take pictures, and then bring that back, and we use a forum process, which consists of a conversation, a meeting between the inspector, senior staff, a supervisor, legal counsel, and we will discuss the particulars of each case and, again, ensure we follow our penalty policy and internal guidance in accordance with the violations that are seen on site.
Next is Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Kadalka, or to the author, or one of the testifiers, I just want to do a follow-up. Does now the MPCA, in the new language, it's operate a SSTS system? I'm assuming just having water leave your home is operating a system. Would that be true?
Madam Chair and members, is there a specific spot? I'm sorry,
page 13, line 32.
Madam Chair and committee members, it would have to deal with a septage issue, not just water leaving. It would have to be someone's toilet running a straight pipe. Technically, they're not operating a system. It's a pipe. So in that regards, there doesn't need to be a system there, but it still has to stay in the world of septic wastewater and the like. It's not for gutter runoff or the like. I guess I'm a little fuzzy on the question. I'm sorry.
Sorry, Madam Chair, Commissioner Kadalka, if your home has an operating septic system, that would qualify under lines 1331 through 34. If you have an operating system, a septic system, the water leaving the septic system, as long as it's an operating system, that's what you're talking about? A regular home with an operating septic system that's conformed, got pumped out 2 months ago, and it's all up to snuff with the county and everything?
Madam Chair and committee members, just above that on lines 13.31, it says performs labor and services. This is for the folks that do the work, that's the design, install, construction. The field citation is not something that we're looking to use for individuals that operate a system. And any time a field citation would be used or any type of penalty, there needs to be a violation. In the case what you were describing there, if someone has a home and they're operating it and the system is working in a proper manner, there wouldn't be a situation where we would have any ability, no matter what our tool is, to carry out a letter of warning or a penalty if deemed necessary. But this is specifically for those who are installing it, not the homeowner.
So thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Kadalka, I just wanted to clarify that a CO can't come on the property just because they have a septic system. You're saying they would need to have a pumper truck in their yard, then the CO would have the authority to come on there at their home.
Madam Chair, committee members, I can't foresee a situation where a conservation officer would simply show up on a site unless there was perhaps a complaint or something or reason to believe that there was some kind of problem or potential violation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to comment on that. I'll just get myself in trouble. My original questions were on page 12. I'm in regards to section 9. Can you tell me... I'm really perplexed here. I'm trying to understand. I would think our goal would be to have people fix the problems we're having and less be centered on penalizing them more money. What is somebody doing? And you use this as example. You're changing from order to orders on line 12.29. $10,000 is not a big enough fine to get somebody to agree to fix what's wrong, which I believe is what we should be trying to do. Let's have them fix what's wrong and move on. $10,000 is not enough if, say, there was two parties involved. We need to be able to collect as much as $40,000. Why can't we accept $10,000 as a big enough fine if we get this thing fixed in the short order? You talk about how it gives the flexibility to do the quick remedy. And you kind of forget the fact, if the quick remedy is what you want, let's work on that. And what are these fines? What are they getting fined, $10,000, that's not enough, that you need to hit them with 40? You use this talk about, we'll have to use that long, drawn-out process, that we don't want to do that. We just want to do the quick process. Why not do the quick process? What are they doing that you got to fine them 40 grand for? What's one that you've... that you said 10 grand's not enough, we need to fine them 40 to fix it. Even though we got agreement on everything on fixing it, we need to get 40 grand from them. What are they doing? Give me some real-life examples.
Representative Portman, did you want to? Oh, Madam Chair, I thought he was going to go to the inflation point, which I could certainly answer, but I think the question that he's asked is more suitable for agency staff.
Madam Chair, committee members, the MPCA's ultimate goal of the compliance and enforcement program is to return a facility and a site to compliance, not simply to gain penalties on behalf of the state of Minnesota. We have a large amount of tools in our toolbox, ranging from a simple phone call, an inspection letter, notice of violation, letters of warning, all non-penalty actions, and then ranging up to administrative penalty order and stipulation agreement type documents. For all the inspections that we conduct, only about one-third of total inspections actually result in enforcement actions, and of those, only about a quarter actually have penalties. So the majority of our enforcement actions do not contain penalties. We reserve penalties for those situations where there is actual environmental harm or a great potential for environmental harm, or when the violations were have been repeated over a period of time by that same violator. So we have lots of examples ranging from, you know, discharge of materials into, you know, impaired waters to burning and burying, you know, waste and hazardous waste. All sorts of examples of egregious environmental violations that are out there. But like I said, overall, the majority of our enforcement actions are non-penalty carrying, if we even get to the enforcement arena.
Representative Thiel?
No, I wasn't done, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry.
She hasn't answered my question yet. Give me a couple of examples.
Like a $10,000 case versus like a $40,000.
Madam Chair and committee members, some of the examples that we'll use some of the examples that fall more in the $20,000 range. So in 2010, we did a stipulation agreement for a $20,000 penalty for unpermitted wastewater discharge from an animal processing plant. That was direct discharge of unregulated materials going into a waterway. Another example, we did a $19,000 penalty for unpermitted and improper disposal of asphalt waste within the water table. Again, a direct impact where our waters are being affected by materials going into them. So there's a direct impact there of the harm. As mentioned, if someone does this willfully or there's a long pattern history of it, that's built in for a deterrence factor, but also economic gain is one possibility. If someone willfully knew that they were evading a permit fee for a number of years, they received an economic gain by not paying that permit fee during those times. And so sometimes the penalty is to cover that amount to put them on the same playing field as everyone else that has been doing things correctly. So those are some of the cases. I hope that helps.
Madam Chair, thank you. Commissioner Kudelka, that does help. So why would you have gone through all that process to find the one $19,000 when you could have sat down with them, find them $10,000, save the agency a ton of money, done the quick process, find them $10,000, got them to quit doing what they're doing? You went through all that extra work, I believe you said, for $19,000, when the current process would have allowed you to get it done, get the thing cleaned up, and get them to fix what they're doing. What's the drive to put people through this instead of fixing it and cleaning it and getting them to stop right away? Where's the agency? I just don't get this. I would think you'd want to clean it up and move on and get them to quit right away.
Madam Chair and committee members, that is our first intent, to have anything cleaned up or the stopping of the discharge. But along those lines of what was mentioned, well, EPA and our numbers, we do compare what it is in like circumstances. We have to hold the same folks accountable just like we do to others. This isn't something that's just uniform to the PCA. This is tax evasion. The same things, processes for robbery and burglaries. There, the person stopped from robbing homes, but there's still a financial penalty to them. It's how the entire enforcement system in the state works beyond just MPCA.
The final one, Madam Chair, thank you. Well, Representative Kudelka, Commissioner Kudelka, I just think sometimes it would be great if the agency, and I hope you folks do it once in a while, throw your suit off when you get done with the session, put a pair of blue jeans and a pair of Red Wing boots on, and go out and actually get on the ground and talk to these people that you'd fined $19,000 and made them go through whatever. Did they do something wrong? Evidently, definitely so. But I think if we sit down and talk with these people and get it fixed, no, I'm not hung up. You haven't convinced me that you did the right thing by finding them 19 instead of 10. And now I think what we've done is, you just told me you went through all this process to get $9,000 out of them. When in reality, what I see on the ground is sometimes we could have cleaned the situation up, done better for the environment if we'd have used a quicker process. And I don't know if I understand what the push is here. I just wish the agency would work more towards what your goal really is, less pollution and working with people, and less, if you listen to the focus here, it's been all about the fines, the penalties, and oh my God, what these people are doing wrong. They burnt the treated 2x4, and they may have done it willfully. Well, truthfully, some young guy or gal threw the 2x4 in there. He willfully threw the 2x4 in. He didn't know it was so dirty. It was green or whatever. I mean, it sounds, I threw it in. I knew I did. He may even know it was green, didn't know it was wrong. But I just, I don't know for sure if this is better or worse. You haven't convinced me for sure. I certainly am open to the idea. But I think the way to approach this is less fines, more working together. Get out there and talk to people and use some common sense so that people, I mean, we're petrified that this bill may allow a CO. I'm sorry, if you think COs don't want to come on our property just because they can, they do. And if they got a chance now that if there's a septic bumper in the yard, they can come blowing in to check what else they might see. I mean, not so much in my part of the state, but if you live up where these guys live, they're petrified up north of COs. And unfortunately, sometimes for good reason. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Kiel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, have you discussed these new proposals for penalties with this of the septic system violations with actual businesses? Have you talked to them about what they're thinking in this?
Madam Chair and committee members, we have had conversations with the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association, that is the trade group for septic system installers and the like, regarding this information. So our septic team, our SSTS team, has had those conversations, and throughout that they've let us know that they are fine with the language as we have drafted it.
Oftentimes folks who are doing a good job want their good job recognized, and the people who are doing it doesn't help them for people who are doing a bad job. Did you have another question?
Yes, thank you, ma'am. Madam Chair. I'm wondering if you've discussed this with, you sounds like you've talked to people who are involved, complying already. Have you talked to just general businesses that may not be as involved, random?
Madam Chair and committee members, we've done it with a trade organization. We've had conversations with the Implementation Enforcement Task Force, which includes counties and other professionals that are involved in this, along with the advisory council that we have on SSTS. So we've talked to a number of folks that have their hands in this. Counties have for a number of times been talking to us about the need of making sure that we make sure that our compliance issues are done in a timely manner. But I don't know. I'd have to talk to staff to see what amount we've done, just looking through our license list and calling someone up. I don't know if we've done that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would encourage that because, as Representative McNamara said, a lot of people are very scared when we hear MPCA coming to check something out. We have no idea what's coming at us, what you're looking at. And my question then, second question is do you do anything to encourage, advise, educate people when they're looking for directly in businesses? Like when you notice a violation, maybe even that business can't afford to necessarily fix everything that needs to be done right away. Is there a timeline? But how do you educate when you're looking at that?
Madam Chair and committee members, as mentioned earlier, a number of our inspections never end up in the penalty phase. And many of those are those type of communications you're talking about, or we do a letter of warning or something like that so we have it documented in case there's a pattern that keeps continuing on. So there's always that continuing education when something's evolved. And sometimes when our inspectors are out there, they're walking them through explaining how they can make the fix. In terms of whether it's a septic system or anything else, we look at what the problem is and then devise a schedule to meet that. Some things can be done very quickly fixed if it's just turning a nozzle and turning off a spigot, versus building a manure a holding system or a new system for a mine. We understand that, and we do give additional time for that because we understand you can't just do that overnight. In terms of any new program, we do outreach as we continue to move forward on it. And those first couple years when there's new programs, when there are new regulations, it's more education when we're going out and doing inspections than any type of penalty. Again, penalties used only in those very cases which are more egregious than some of the run-of-the-mill issues.
One last comment, and I appreciate your education. I have someone, a constituent in my district, that was trying to put up a new manure pit, and this is before some of the dates of making sure that the permits were all in that 90 days, but this went on. There was no agreement for a permit long after the 90 days. In fact, this business finally called down to the state and had someone come on site, and they said, what are we missing? We keep trying to find get this set up. Wanted to do it in a timely fashion because, as you know, up north, if you don't do it at a certain time by October, it's very hard to pour cement or any of those types of things that need to be done. When the state came down, they could not figure out why they were not given the permit 3 months in advance. Everything was in compliance, needed to do it. It seemed that whoever was on the ground up in the Northwest area did not understand what they were supposed to be allowing. So just something for you to know. It was very frustrating to the business. It took them over a year to get something done that should have lasted maybe 6 months. Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I raised my concern, then I have a question. I'll probably have a follow-up question as well. You know, similar down the same thought process, what I get concerned about is if we have this gotcha mentality, and if we are collecting more money towards fines, we have less dollars that'll go towards the actual corrective measures. And my concern is, Representative Torkelson raised it up about when we changed the law that allowed the PCA to collect 100% of the fines versus some of those going into the general fund, that we actually saw an increase of fines levied. And we were critics of that, and I believe that was changed back. Help me understand, maybe this is to the author, but help me understand why we would have put the penalties on autopilot versus coming back to the legislature and asking for those to be increased at a later date.
Madam Chair, excuse me, Representative Hamilton, we are not putting the penalties on an inflator. The penalties are in a different section of statute. This is the limit that would apply to the simpler process. If you think about it like conciliation court, a few years ago here in the legislature, we raised the limit from $7,500 to $15,000. So say you sold me a car and it was worth $10,000. Before we changed the limit for conciliation court, I would have had to take you to real court if I wanted to sue you and pay the real court filing fee and probably hire a lawyer, and it would be expensive, time-consuming. By changing the limit for conciliation court to $15,000, we put a whole bunch of people who didn't really want to be in district court with all the expenses attendant to that into conciliation court. So what the inflator applies to is the threshold to get into the APOs, not the maximum fines. So the maximum fines are in Chapter 115, and they're not changing with inflation.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Commissioner, you brought up, and you and I had talked about this, and so my question is about the electronic permits and whatnot. One of the ideas or what we are talking about is if we could go online and be able to answer the questions, and in the event you inadvertently left one out, a red flag would pop up and bring you back to that so that we didn't have this ping-pong effect. Are we moving any closer, or where are we at in that process?
Madam Chair and committee members, we're working in twofold in that. One is the new electronic application submission program will do that, just like Amazon. If you don't fill out a form, we would create that problem. We're also on a separate tool doing a proof of concept. It is a new system that we're testing for dairy farms, and then I think it's small auto body shops, which would not be the permit system per se, you would go online, put in your information, and it would start to say, well, this is what your permit would be. In the case of a feedlot permit, say you're at 1,050 animal units, it'll pop up and say, do you know if you were, you know, 60 animal units less, you wouldn't need this permit, or you wouldn't need to go through environmental review. Or if you're in a body shop, if you're using this chemical, if you use chemical B, you wouldn't have to be in this permit system. We're trying to prove the, see if that works, that type of system. We're having a small vendor take care of it. Actually, we've shared that with the dairy producers, a first glimpse of it, along with the chamber. They're getting us some feedback, and we hope next month to give some legislators a glimpse of what that would look like. So that it's two different ones. The actual application process would have some of those things you're talking about, and in the next year we should be getting closer to unveiling that, but then a more interactive tool to help someone find out ways to make it easier on them and the permitting system and environmental benefits. Or
thank you. And this would go back to what Representative Keel said. You know, there's in our system, we hired away someone like you referred to, someone from your department, to make sure that we're 100% in compliance. But if we'd have something like this to help smaller farmer, to on the permitting side, to make sure that they've got 100% of everything that's submitted, I think that'd go a long way for some of these smaller farmers as well. Thank you.
You know, this is, we are discussing a lot of policy. This is, how many stops have you been, Representative?
Madam Chair, this is the fifth.
And this is a finance committee. And I am looking at the time here, so we are going to be voting on this bill very shortly. Now that we've had lots and lots of policy discussion, and I think it'll help for when we get to the floor, and it'll certainly shorten the debate. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will try to restrict my question to financial matters.
Excellent.
And fiscal implications.
Very good.
Just one more time to Section 9. I just want to be assured that as a result of these changes, as you make the choice, the agency makes a choice between whether to use the APO or the STIP, that you are deciding, making this decision based on what's best for the environment and best for our citizens, rather than making the decision based on what generates the most net revenue for the department. Can you assure me that that's the case?
Madam Chair and committee members, we will continue to look, and our first goal is what's good for the environment and public health and bringing someone into compliance. One of the benefits that we haven't talked about that my colleague mentioned to me here is a reminder, parts of APOs are forgivable. So when we talk about the APOs, in many cases there's a large chunk, if not all of them, are forgivable if it's a first-time issue. It's the more serious and repeat situations where it tends not to be forgivable.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me there's a risk here that the department's going to look at their choices here and say, well, we're going to generate more money for the department if we use this broader APO authority that's granted in this bill rather than going through the STIP just because it's more money for the department.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you raised the issue. You said that there's lots of people who are doing really good out there. And Representative Keel and Representative Hamilton and Representative McNamara also talked about the perception that a lot of people have about the agency. And I know that there's a lot of businesses in my district who have tried to be good stewards and have tried to work through the system and have tried to do good, but yet the agency comes down on them with financial penalties, making life difficult for them. And I want to see a change in the culture within the agency. I just don't see that. And we've had offline conversations about the gas station in Winnoska and the generator situation at different businesses. And folks, you have to understand that the agencies in the state of Minnesota generate about $20 billion worth of revenue. I don't know for sure what the numbers are within MPCA, but I'm not convinced that this is not just the camel's nose under the tent to raise more revenue and create more problems. under the disguise of doing good for the environment. So that's my point. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thank you for the latitude today. Just a quick question. I'm going back again on Section 10, lines 1331 in that paragraph. We already have laws pertaining to the design. You have to be certified to design a system, to install it, to construct, to inspect it. So what's the real purpose of this language? Again, it kind of seems to indicate that we're going at the enforcement part of this again and allowing more, another agency to police this. So what's the real purpose of that new language beginning on 1331?
Madam Chair and committee members, you are correct. All of these items are under current law already illegal. What this is doing is, again, just changing where we can use the tool. What we're doing here, this section of statute outlines what type of, Section 10 outlines what type of situations a field citation can be used. And then Section 11 of the bill actually has the specific dollar amount for the penalty and caps built into it. So all it's doing is being very prescriptive of what the penalty is. There's no change on the inspection process by the agency or a conservation officer. If someone sees a straight pipe, they'll report it to the agency, and it's agency staff then working with that person. All we're changing is, instead of going through an administrative penalty order, because we're seeing these being exactly the same, much like you do a ticket for speeding where they're all very similar, we're putting out the schedule of violations there, and the agency just uses that.
Is there anybody from the public who would like to say a word on this bill? I don't see any. I don't see any further questions. I renew my motion that House File 2543, as amended, be re-referred to the committee and rules and legislative administration. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition?
No.
It has been referred. Is there somebody who would be so gracious as to move the minutes of Wednesday, March 26th? Yes, Representative Freeburg will do that. All those in favor of the minutes say aye.
Aye.
Any oppositions? The minutes are adopted. There's no further business, and we adjourn.